Does everyone have a copy? There's a few more. Does anyone need copies? Rosen. I'm the Behavioral Health Director at Midwest Wissowa Health Center. I want to talk a little bit about how I got into this topic. So our clinic at Midwest Wissowa is kind of a family clinic, and where that came from is my specialty is in post-traumatic stress disorder. And when I was working in New Haven, Connecticut, we had what's called an open family model. I don't know where they put the slide.
Okay, we did it as a PowerPoint, right?
Yes.
Okay, and where's the keyboard that was here?
Right here.
Okay, thank you. I'll get her.
So the open family process at the clinic was that you would meet with families who were going through foster placements or were in pre-adoption foster situations, having been through severe trauma, and we would have a therapist for each of the clients, each of the members of the family, and the parents, and we would meet all together. Each therapist, each patient, we talk about what's happening during the day, what's happening, what are the issues that were coming up. Then we would separate, we would all talk with each of the clients, and then we would come back together. So the reason why that was really helpful is we get everyone's perspective on what was happening. Everyone had an advocate in the room, and then everyone would be able to talk through how to communicate about that issue. So, and then after that work there, I went to a private clinic where we had the experience where most private centers, parents bring their child, and then they drop them off, they have therapy for an hour, and then they go back to their families, and how much change really happens if they don't work with the family? Not too much, right? So, when I decided to become the director of Midwest Wissowa, I decided that we were not going to have that model. We were going to work with the parents. It was a condition upon the center that we required parents to be part of the process. You have to have at least once a month check-in with the parents. The parents had to be there during session and had to start the session with their child. We didn't have to know what was going on. So now what ended up happening at Midwest Wissowa is that we got lots of referrals for divorcing families.
Can I do an infomercial for Dr. Rosen for one second? I am Debbie Kardashian. I do the consultation in most of your schools. She is seeing families at all of your schools. You know those families that are your hero? She's probably seeing them. So listen up. She's doing a lot of good for us. She's keeping your hair intact. Don't pull it out.
So we see every variation of separation, divorce, every variation of good, bad, and the worst. Okay? So let's go a little bit through what these look like, because I often find, even in starting this work, not knowing in Illinois what this can look like. All right. So a little smile on the screen so you can see it on your paper, hopefully.
Oh, that is really crazy. Forgive me,
you're not going to read that. All right, so let's talk about common and uncommon language, and I will explain what they are, so hopefully you can write them next to it. Discernment counseling. Now, a lot of people have never heard what this is. Now, this is a referral that you would make for someone who's not sure if they want to get divorced. It's actually a specialized type of therapy that you send a person who's considering whether they want a divorce to decide if they want a divorce. It's for the parents who might think about divorce. It helps them decide. Right? So this is before they actually make steps. This is a very helpful thing for someone to consider because it helps them think about it and consider it and maybe not make the decision. Okay? Legal separation. This is where they technically actually remain married legally, but the court divides the property and the debts. So it is a legal separation, but they're technically married still. Okay, that is a situation people can be in, and the court can make that legal separation for them. Mediation. Many of the families in the Jewish community choose not to do this, which I cannot understand why we don't start with mediation. So please make this a more common terminology in our community if we can more know about it. It is a process where the spouses communicate through an individual who is not necessarily a lawyer. It is an amicable process where they discuss the terms of potentially agreement before it's turned into the court.
I can tell you why people don't do it.
Yes.
As someone who's been through this. So mediation is legally required before divorce in cases of custody. People don't go through private mediation because it's very expensive. It's not funded by, you can ask, Project Shalom Bias, and you can just email them, whatever. You can ask Project Shalom Bias to help you, but mediators are very, very, very expensive. So, people don't.
So are divorce attorneys where it gets really, really messy.
Right, right. But once you get to that point, so a lot of couples, instead of mediation, they go to counseling, couple counseling, which is often paid for by insurance.
So this is once they've already decided divorce.
But once you've already decided divorce, mediation is required legally. You can do it through the state, it's free. You have to get it, in a line for that, but...
So this is instead of getting a divorce attorney, right?
We're right, but most people don't do that. They do couples counseling instead of mediation because there's some way to pay for that. Mediators are very, very expensive.
Okay.
Instead, you don't know why more people don't do it.
So then there's collaborative divorce, which is where it's a specialized style of divorce attorneys, which is a different type of process where the two different divorce attorneys actually work together to come up with a more mediated structure outside of the court system. So that is a different process, and there are attorneys that talk about being collaborative divorce attorneys. It's meetings outside of the court. Nesting, if you haven't heard this term before, is where the kids are staying in one home and the parents are moving back and forth between that home, and they're staying in another place separately. Guardian ad litem. So this is a term when there is an attorney that is hired or a court-appointed person that is hired to protect the children. So this is often done as you hear that there is one in a very, very messy divorce situation. It is a third party, so there's usually an attorney for the mom, attorney for the dad, and then a guardian ad litem for the children. Okay? And then a 604-10B evaluation is when there is an evaluation being done to determine custody for the children. This is when the parents can't come to an agreement and the court has to determine by evaluation. Generally having to do by a mental health professional or a court-determined professional. Okay, those are exceedingly expensive and usually a last resort if we can get to that point. Okay, so just a little bit about the timelines. They can be very, very long. So when you hear about a separation, it can be to the process of 2 years. We're not talking about a short-term process for some people. And it can be varying. So I put in here that there is process, but sometimes separation does not mean necessarily that they're going for a divorce. There is process. Some people get reunified. Right? So separation is not the same as divorce. Okay? So there are times where one partner will request a divorce and then a separation will happen, and there are other times where a partnership will decide to separate and then from the separation decide that one of them wants
a divorce. Right? So there's different processes that could happen in terms of decision making. And then they might decide on a mediator or attorney at that point. There are usually two parts to a process in terms of getting divorced, the financial agreement and the parental agreement. And then there's the court filing portion. Now, those portions may be filed at different points in time, and there are different points of contention on those and different filings. So that's the part that will take a long time, is when the courts are involved and if they're contested. The terms of the get process, that will be based on when the baking assessment of when they should get that if in the process of this whole piece. Okay? All right. Now, different forms of parental communication. Now, I don't know if anyone has ever heard of Our Family Wizard. Anyone heard of that before? Okay. Now, when you look at the website, and you click on it, it sounds like it's a really nice way to communicate. If someone is using that way to communicate, what does that indicate?
It means they're speaking to each other kindly.
Right. So when that has been given as a referral to families to use, it's actually an indication that they cannot communicate well.
Tell me four words you have to use.
So all forms of communication between those parents has to be documented through that computer application. So it means they're not allowed to communicate in any other way. So if a family is using that
ding, 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 red flag.
Okay? Very big. Red flag. All right, about how intense the fighting might be in that house between the parents. Right, so then you also have they're only communicating between text and email.
Mark, can you talk a little bit more about how that creates guide rails for the family? Are there certain things that the app allows you to do or doesn't allow you to do? Like, I don't understand if they're not communicating well by email, can they also not communicate well on the app?
Oh, yeah, it's like vicious in between. They'll like send.
But it's just on an app.
It's on an app, and their attorneys see everything, the court sees everything, and I can't get over what they still write on there, and that they're okay with the court.
Okay, so it's basically just what people see.
This is what they're publicly allowing everyone to see, and it goes back and forth, and this is their dialogue. It's all on there. It's like they forget that people are watching.
The only advantage of the app is that it has some sort of mechanism with words being used that are like indicator words that will tell you this is a confrontational statement or it's not how confrontational such a statement is.
So it'll say like, do you still want to use this word?
It will alert you to the fact that they have a Utah signal bar as to how confrontational the statement that you're making is. And if you still get 70, even if it's like two or times
the same,
you can sort of my life.
So, right. So then you have the families that are only texting and emailing, which also means they can't have a verbal conversation. Right? Then you have some that can communicate, and then there are some that can have collaborative meetings. But I want you to kind of think through what that means for you as a teacher, as an administrator, right? Because if you are dealing with a family that are in one of those different areas, what that means for you being able to communicate with them, and what that means for parent-teacher conferences, what that means for communicating about homework, what that means for communicating about how the kids are doing, right? You can't have a Zoom session with two parents if they're only going to be communicating via email and text to each other. They cannot be in a Zoom session together.
Legally?
Sometimes. Okay. Right? But also, if they can't communicate that way, do you want to be in a Zoom session with them? Right? It's like, think about putting yourself in that situation.
I guess sometimes you work with the hardest cases, but can you give us a sense of what percent-ish in the Jewish community the buckets are here?
I don't have a way to do that because I see really probably the worst, so I don't really have a good sense, honestly. I think the schools would have to probably give a broader range, honestly.
The parents also have to
be honest about it.
Right, they have
so
to let us know.
So as I was putting together this presentation, I was talking with a colleague about it, and she had said to me, she's like, wow, like, half the time we don't even know and how it's like way into behavior and what's actually happening. And that kind of also not, so I'm sort of a mental health professional, not knowing what the teachers, the schools are experiencing. Because by the time they come to me, right, we're already in the thick of it, usually. But I don't know what the way is to get families to be more transparent about what's going on, to open up.
It's very, I'm still a little whack. I've been, in 23 years, I've been divorced, gone through the system on multiple different levels. So I have, represented by public court as an attorney, like, and really one of the major issues is to destigmatize divorce as a whole and to get community verb on board with the understanding that this is not it's not speaking negatively about one person. These two people can't be married, it's not working.
Right.
So here, one of the things I think you left out, not intentionally, but in your earlier slide, is rabbinic involvement. And when you have, and we all teach entire schools here, and therefore, that I can't imagine there's not families that don't have a rug somehow connected to the family. Even when there's a separation, that in my ex-wife has a rug and I have a rug, those two rabbanim need to work together to discuss what's going on. And they have a level of rabbinic engagement, and then the rabbanim need to figure out how to speak to couples with how to speak to the school and the wife. But here, as Mrs. Kardesh gave a shout out before, I'm giving a full shout out to the Abbez Institute, the Rabbi Reese, who is masterful at mediating and working with couples in divorce. And I can tell you personally, in the last year, I've sent no less than a dozen men to him to try and keep the people think that going to a lawyer is the first option.
Right.
Going to a lawyer is like when your car runs out of gas and you buy a new car instead of filling up. That's the point of the lawyer.
That was an excellent segue into what Dr. Rosen is going to do. I do definitely hear you, and I think Mrs. Lovavitz also pointed out, families often have a lot of chaos before they tell the school. So I want to get Dr. Rosen's opportunity to talk about how to support those kids when we start finding out in the school.
So I think one of the things that I appreciate, and this is actually, and I'm going to maybe just open up a bit too, this is actually this is new for the clinic, right, we've only been open 2 years, is, and I appreciate this adding this in, is I want feedback on this presentation so we can continue to improve it. And I think when I think about the couples that are in the messiest situation in our clinic, I actually don't think they have connections to the response. Honestly. And I think that's maybe why it's been. I just want to put that in there, but that also might be some of the problem.
We can agree to disagree on it, but it's a matter of Rabbanim deciding that this is my problem,
right.
And it is a problem in my community, and I need to be involved in it. And even though I can tell you, for a government president, that is a shoulder roll, how many questions you get about your milk and spoon and your plate and pot versus this is your issue.
What I'm suggesting is that these individuals move away from their connection as a result of what's going on, and therefore they're not seeking where I think they could support. And maybe that's part of what might be helpful for them is to actually seek support, and then maybe it would be easier for them to understand how to, I'm just thinking about some of the cases.
And those people are calling me at 11 o'clock at night saying, by the way, I give an hour to talk, and no, I don't, but I'm going to talk to you anyway. Yeah.
All right. So, one of the things that, as always, as a trauma therapist, I think about what's going on for these individuals when they're going through this. So, when a person is experiencing, so to speak, especially the children, a complex situation where they're feeling a certain amount of threat, right? So whether the home itself is threatening because there's a lot of fighting, which might be happening in some of these homes, or because simply they don't know what's going to happen to them, right? There's a lot of ambiguity for some of them. The situation is not explained well. They don't know maybe where they're going to be, because sometimes when families are going through this situation, the parents are also in a state of ambiguity, not knowing where their livelihood's going to, how it's going to affect them, where they're going to live. Sometimes we have experiences where one family member is locked out of the house, right? So that creates a certain lack of safety, not knowing for these children what's going to happen, where is their dad, where might their mom be, right? And so when we talk about how the brain handles these things, right, and we think about where children go when they feel overwhelmed emotionally, right, they go into the limbic system, right, then into the brainstem, which is not where their functioning needs to be for school, right? We simply just know that that's not a state that's going to help them function at school. They're going to be dysregulated. So if they're coming from home in a dysregulated state, or they just had an intense drop-off situation between parents, they're showing up to your classroom in probably an emotional dysregulated state, right? Additionally, if you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, and you think about where they need to be educationally, right, they are not in a state in which they are thinking about their emotional development. They're not in a self-esteem state. They're definitely not in a we're hanging out with community state. We're not in a self-actualization state. We are in a safety need state, right? So when you're bringing them higher level functioning, thinking, and you're trying to get them to connect with their peers, they're down in a lower state of being. Right? Some of them are still focusing how they're going to make sure their lunches are packed this morning, because not every parent is on with it when they're going through this state of being. So, I think it's important to also consider the different types of schedules that people might be on. And you don't understand sometimes how complex this is. So I want you to kind of see visually what parents and their kids might be going through. Because if you think it's hard to keep your school schedule going, try being a parent or a child on a schedule where it's mom 3 days, dad 3 days, mom for Shabbos, then back to mom, like this is what they're going through. And they're trying to keep track of their homework. Yeah. Right? They don't know where their shoes are. What house is their shoes in? Right? And then their mom 1 week, their dad the next week, maybe, or this schedule. Can you imagine if they have this schedule? Right? But some parents don't know what to do. So they're doing this because they're trying to make it work because they want to see their kids every other day, right? So some parents get in different types of routines with their children. But like really, if you're planning their homework and you have a kid in your classroom, right, and they have a project due at the end of the week, and they started at mom's house on Monday, and then they have 2 days at dad's house, are they going to get to work on that project? And then they're also going to do Friday, they got one more day? I mean,
you have to be careful with communication tools, because sometimes the parent will pull that with his fault or her fault, and then it becomes another bone of contention that the kid's going to have to deal with.
And then you get back to the picture up here where I had, this is one of my favorite images of where the kid's like, between two parents, being like, you know, feeling like a go-between for these two parents. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned that this process might take 2 or 3 years.
Uh-huh.
Get to some sort of stability that even exists. Can you give us a sense also, like these kinds of schedules
might be permanent.
Might be permanent,
yeah.
Which is more helpful.
Yeah.
But to what extent do we see like huge changes in the first 6 months, in the first year of this kind of process? Is there? I mean,
you can't. So sometimes it's like they try something and then it might not work. But sometimes it's coming from the beginning as they. Can't agree on something, sometimes the court changes, the guardian ad litem.
How quickly can the court say, this is what this going to mean?
Not
very fast. Like, no. They might say, like...
If you file a motion today in court, you're waiting about 3 months to see a judge.
Right. So, that can happen. But I've also seen, like, we had a case where nothing, they filed nothing of the court, and the court, the judge made this ridiculous decision that the father couldn't see anybody. And then all of a sudden he was in supervision with the kid. I mean, it was one of those things randomly happen that you just don't anticipate. And all of a sudden the father was in court supervised care with the children and wasn't having overnight anymore. And it was.
And the kids have no control over this, right?
None.
I remember what the kids spilling in.
No, and they were so angry at the therapist thinking we had something to, I mean, it was crazy.
Guardian of guardian to become a state certified guardian of item, you need to take one course as a student attorney with the Cook County Court, and then you're all of a sudden a guardian of item. It doesn't mean you have any clue about child psychology or anything within the child's best interest, but you are they're the legal representatives for the child, but they have no clue what the child's social and emotional
needs. Some are better than others, some have been fantastic and some have been horrible. We have been a mixed experience. You know, we've gone to several of them.
Do they advocate on what the child is expecting they need or what they feel the child needs?
Depends on which one.
Okay.
Some, I guess I said, some I feel like are good and really like listen and think through things, and others I feel like have their own agenda and they decide what they think it should be and they've.
Someone won't even call people like Dr. Rosen to ask what her opinion is
right.
After having seen the kids, seen the family. You know, they won't even pick up the phone to call her and say, Dr. Rosen, what's your impression of what I should be saying here? Because it's not in their best interest to take the time. And those bills will be $400.
So we talked a lot about these, like, we talked a little about these things, but just to put them in, you know, in your mind, you know, is really like, you know, what to consider the idea of, like, switching between these different places and what it might be like for these children. Because that's really what you're dealing with in the classroom. Is when they're switching, that's what's coming in your situation, into your classroom in the morning, right? Or what's going home, because you might even see at the end of the day, them knowing they're going to a different parent's house, what do they need? What do they have to pack up? What is the I don't know if there's nervous energy going on, right? You knowing their schedule is one of my top priorities for you, if you can get it. Right? Obviously, they have to communicate it to you, but if you know their schedule, that's tremendously helpful.
What's a tactful or correct way to find that out?
Are you asking the parents?
Ask the parents, or they ask the kids? Or like,
no, I would ask the parents. Ask the parents.
The fact that they're nosy, like to just.
I mean,
I don't think it's nosy. I think that's really appropriate to know where the child is going every day. I think it's really appropriate, not nosy.
Right.
Because the child might also ask you. They might be confused. If you know, you can say, oh, if your mom's picking you up and here's an extra homework sheet, and this is the place that you could get extra sets of textbooks,
right.
And we just dispense with the library fines. The book is never coming back. Don't worry about it.
Right. So you need to know, right, so what challenges they might have for homework, projects, remembering items for school. So
in terms of finding out that information, right? Say the parents are not communicating, you know that's happening. Whose purview is it to find that information? Is it the administration? Is it the teachers? What's appropriate?
I think it should start with the administration.
Okay.
The administration, and this is where I'll go into the higher up part, the administration should really have on file any court-related documents.
Okay.
Because if there are court-related documents, you need to know what it says.
Okay.
Because we've gotten in this situation. You might have on file with the court who you're allowed to talk to and who you're not allowed to talk to. Because that can be written in there.
Okay.
There are documents, like we currently have a family, not allowed to talk to mom. Like, at all. So, it's
and
a legally...
And if you do come into legal issues.
Yeah. Because the medical decision maker is that, period.
So a lot of those, you know, what you've been discussing is dealing with a really clear, broad, like, inside into what a child could be experiencing, very severe lack of confidence in really anything going on in their lives. So as a band and as teachers, a lot of us would like to be, you know, a source of comfort for our students. What would you recommend is a good way to sort of exude that without crossing any of these sorts of, as you had mentioned, perhaps over into you know, I mentioned the word no D or anything like that, like how, what's a good way that a resident or a teacher can, you know, communicate their support for the student?
Sure. So,
some students don't want to talk about it and like close up, you know, and some would be like, so that, what would be a good way to navigate that?
Right. So the question is, have they mentioned it to you at all? Right? So if you know it at all, what's going on, right? And they start to, like, clamp up. Like, I would just reference, like, what do you need to be present today? Right? What is the need in the classroom right now to be able to do the work? Right? Because they don't want to get into maybe what's happening, right? But they obviously are here, right? And you want to recognize something's going on, right? What can I do? Right? You mean like, I don't know, your high school teacher or elementary school?
Eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. Right? So sometimes they need, you know, a few minutes to pull themselves together. Like sometimes you do small ritual kind of things, like how do you separate home from, right? Like there's a nice next class. Right? Like what is it that they need to kind of center themselves for that focus? Right? Or do they need some kind of vision kind of thing, and you know, that can be a totally different type of school environment, to be able to switch their mindset, right?
I think just the intervention of asking, you know, what came to my mind is just, especially if you know the schedule and the transition occurs, just to make a special effort to say, good morning, I'm happy to see you, or hey, you know, doing okay. Monday mornings are so often the transition point, and I know some kids younger haven't seen their mom or, you know, for a while, and so they might be thinking about, I can't wait to get to Monday to see mom. And so just to check in, to touch emotionally, you know, that intervention just does it.
I've had some who say that, like, downtime is particularly difficult, but even like tequila, because also the mind kind of runs away with it, right? So like noticing those points in time, like, or, like work when they're, you know, simply working on their own, if they start gazing away, like helping them come back because they might be thinking about it, right? But I think what I want to,
I'm sorry. The scheduling thing is great. But I teach high school, and so when I've had situations, parents usually will say about their high school kids, certainly not always, well, he's blah, blah, blah age, and he's in charge of his own schedule, and they oftentimes, like most of us do with our teenage kids, it's his responsibility. It doesn't matter that he stayed at dad or at mom. So the way you framed it before is great, but I'm not sure that I always work at the high school age. So do you have any suggestions
so that is,
for
what
the older
do you,
kids?
So what do you need to do to be able to transition to homework? Like, is it that you need, like, I would ask them,
right?
If you know you're moving between places and it's a project you have to move, right? Or if it's homework you have to bring between places, what do you need to plan for that?
And how flexible with high school kids? Because often I've had situations, I was at my dad's, I forgot it at my mom's, can you give me an extra day, week, month, year, whatever.
So the first day sounded good.
I mean, that is something that we come across.
Right, so I think it's the question is, how much have you tried to create the skills versus how much are they using it to get out? And it's always the question with these things, right? Mm-hmm. It's creating the pathway to skill development because it's not going away. Right. And helping them utilize and using the system that they're in to create a set of different, you know, different ways to manage it and being more proactive. We're going to have to, these kids are going to have to learn to be more proactive with their homework. Right. And it is going to be harder. So the question is, can they step up to do those kinds of things? Can they look at their schedule that way? Or, and we can't, it's going to hold them accountable. Right, to a certain extent. So there are certain, I would give certain leeway, and then others I would say, okay, well, we tried this way, let's, it's time to hold you accountable for it, okay?
So, as I was kind of mentioning with having the paperwork for the administrators particularly, or even, and hopefully trickling down to the teachers, is knowing who, so to speak, is the primary parent. Because in some of these cases, there is a primary parent who has custody, and it isn't a 50-50 split. So in the case when there is 50-50 split, I would encourage you all communication should be to both parents all the time, if that is the way you can do it. If there's a primary parent, know who the decision maker is, and then what level the other parent has. Okay?
And just make sure that your teachers, if you're an administrator, that your teachers have this information.
Yeah.
That tends to be where a lot of sticky situations come up, where teachers are not informed of these kind of little details, or even big ones like that that they're not very informed, and then a lot
it's
of stuff.
It's a really, I feel that our administration guards the family's privacy so tightly that I don't know. And I often wish I did.
And it would be a really big problem because we've had at the clinic a situation where a parent who was not in communication with the kids showed up at the school, gave a letter to the children, and it was a huge problem. It was not physically.
So how do you balance that? Confidentiality, privacy, dignity.
Well, all the families are asked. I can say that from the administration front. Sometimes the families are asked, how much can we share with teachers? And often the times that is nothing. Or you can just say that things are rocky and there's a sense of like, oh, the administration is guarding it, but also part of it is.
It's a public document, like any other criminal record.
Right, but I don't know where those.
Yeah, I just wonder what the capacity of me is to self find out, or if I don't know.
I think this would be a question for the administration. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. A question that comes up. Okay, you can do that. Okay, so a question comes up for teachers often. Even if they, whether it's legal or not legal, they have, let's say, a better relationship with one of the parents, and let's say it's more common to maybe call the mom. But when it's a divorce situation, what's the more correct protocol? If you have a conversation with one parent, have it with the other parent?
It would be best to have it with both parents, because if they are in a situation where I go back to that slide of communication and they are not communicating, if you have it with one parent, it's not a guarantee the other parent's going to know. Like, you really need to have it with both parents, because if you want a behavior change, let's say there's something happening in the classroom that you need to have change, if you have it with only one parent, you may not get it communicated to the other parent. So you really want, if you really want to see that happen,
mm-hmm. do it yourself.
That you kind of have to with these families.
You're working with an assumption that both parents share priorities, and that's, I guess, I don't think a valid assumption here, especially when we're talking about curriculum. Many reasons that divorce happens, especially in the firm world, is that one parent is holding one place at their firm site, and another is holding it in a different place, and so therefore you'll have the Rebbe call, and you know, the parents that. Yeah, I just want my kids to be happy. And the fact that failing tomorrow, I just want them to be happy. I don't care. And then you call the other parent. I'm not gender assigned.
Right.
Then you call the other parent, like, what do you mean they're failing tomorrow? And so then it could work the same, you know, the other way also. Like, one parent cares about general studies, the other doesn't. Which is oftentimes a reason for the cause of the separation and divorce. And then you're like, you're trying to look at the parent, but they are not in sync with each other as to. School is a priority for our kids.
Right. I think it could be even as simple as, for example, like we need the water bottle to come to school.
right? And if parents aren't talking to each other, you may not get the water bottle to school if you don't communicate to both parents. I know it sounds very silly, but like that, it's a preschool. It's not even clear. Like, it may be that simple.
That's
for
the
other.
Really important. I think simply for accountability, whether they're divorced or separated or they have a healthy relationship, whenever I'm going to make a call, I send an email stating that I'm going to call and referring what it's to. So that if that parent chooses not to answer the phone, or that parent, whatever, the other parent can say, I didn't know about it. If I can write to both parents, I could do that.
Which is why I do want to put on, it's a lot of work for teachers, you know, to like have to do both parents, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to do.
Yeah. So I mean, like, when you're reaching out to parents, it's like clear, you can send an email to both. What about when one parent's reaching out to you as a concern? Do you then have to go and like follow that up with a secondary call that the first parent reached out? Like how do you go about that?
That is a really good question. I think it probably depends on what the concern is. And if it's classroom related that the parent is bringing up, right? So like if the child is reporting that this happened in the class, right? I would probably say, yes, it's good for the other parent to know. And I would probably document this in an email to the other parent, that, you know, oh, this is how we dealt with it, so that the other parent knows what's happening, right? Because I think the other parent should know what the intervention was, right? If it's, I'm trying to think of something else might be related. I feel like my child is being treated unfairly with their grades and they're complaining about your teaching style. I don't know if the other parent necessarily needs to know the complaint about your particular, you know, teaching style, if that's an example. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think if it's,
like, there's been ones that are more like, they almost feel a little pointed, like they're trying to get information
from the parent about the...
A few are kind of like, almost like they're looking for some information that's happy to be against the other side. And like...
So that feels
like right. It gets a little tricky.
Right. So I feel like then you're just engaging in this drama with them, and I would just say this is not something for me to answer, and I would just
when one parent pushes out, does it seem like my students' friends? Are they happy? Like they're like looking for
like information on like that's how they're doing in the classroom.
Right.
They're doing at school. That isn't about whether they're happy with the other parents.
No, but they're like looking for information about how that child's doing. Because at times they don't have access to that child, really. So this is kind of like their touch point with that child, because they're not necessarily seeing them more than every other week with the...
So that's my question would be to the administration, are they allowed to have access to that information? Because I wouldn't know if they are allowed to have access. I don't know. So I would also make sure, this is one of the things that I like to do with these families, is also if you send an email to both parents, at the end, can you please confirm that you received it?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes they get so chaotic, the parents are so chaotic, so you want to make sure they actually digest what was said, so can you confirm that you received it?
That should be a second email sent later? Or
no, no, in the bottom of the email. Please confirm that you've read it or that you've gotten it so that we know if they've read it or not. Administrators, if there's administrators in the room, if you're introducing a new platform, please make sure that you can have two people accessing it for the same child. That's an important thing that doesn't always get looked at. So engaging students, as I said, if you can know the important transition days, that's really helpful, right? Looking for patterns related to the start and the end of the day. So this is if you don't have the knowledge of when they're transitioning, but also even the patterns to it, you notice there are certain days they come in a certain way, or they end or leave the day in a certain way. Because then that gives you information to how to start helping them with that part of the day, right? Or that there's something going on with that transition that may be worthwhile talking to the parents about.
right? That they're struggling with that transition, that there's some way we can smooth that out for them. So also, as I mentioned, notice if quiet work time becomes an impulsive time or a daydream time. Because both impulsive also is an indication that they're thinking about it. So while we think that it might be that they are acting out, it's that they're thinking about it, and then they can't handle the thought and they start to act out. So it might be an indication of intrusive thoughts. Teach them to maybe create reminders for homework or transitions between the homes if we're talking about for high schoolers. How can we help them help themselves? Ask parents to keep items at school or a secondary copy of things at home. Like, there's no reason why the water bottle has to go home every day. Keep it at school. Certain things can stay at school and certain things can stay at home. You can have multiple copies of everything. So setting up reminders for parents when children are young for special school activities. So, you know, everyone assigned, you know, Shabbos, Ema kind of things. Like, it would be nice if those things had, like, you know, calendar invites assigned to them, you know, like, or if you actually, like, have parents, hey, remind it, also send a reminder email to them. This is your date for the Shabbos Ema. Sometimes it comes out on a big calendar, right, at the beginning of the year, right? Parents who are in these situations do not remember to put it on their calendars. So a secondary follow-up is always helpful. Not that other parents have that trouble either, okay? But really, really don't. As we talked about, consider timelines for projects. I mean, transition between houses. All right. That's kind of what I have, though, for today. So I'm sure there's plenty more. Questions? Yes.
What have you seen when working with the transition schedule of all the various? What has been like the best answer? What kind of answer? Almost in the best. I have more control.
So
it is 50-50. It's the best case scenario for parents. From there, moving forward, what would be the best transition schedule for kids?
I think it really depends on the age.
Yeah.
Right? The, so I think really the best scenario for elementary kids and younger kids is seeing the parents with a little bit more frequency. So like the whole week is really hard. And then, you know, not too many switches. Somewhere in the middle.
Like that 3 and 3?
Yeah. And then they usually recommend kind of like a 3 and 4 or 5 switch, and then they kind of rotate those kind of switches. Yeah.
If you had one suggestion, like if you had a magic wand and you could give one recommendation to teachers who have students who might be, they are having this life experience, that they could do in their classroom to make their students' life better, what would it be? If you had a magic wand and you say, wow, if you could remember one thing to think about or do, what would it be?
I think that check-in, knowing their schedule, would be probably the most helpful.
So emotionally engaging with the kids.
On the days that they know they're having their hard schedule. Or when they have visitation, which we didn't talk about as much, is when they engage in really complex divorce situations and there's reunification with the parents and they start a visitation schedule. So there's times where that first visitation schedule starts being very emotionally challenging. And so if you know that visitation is starting, those days are going to be tremendously difficult. So those days, checking in and knowing that. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of risk from a teacher perspective in thinking about waiting in and saying the wrong thing. I remember a couple years ago, I said something to a girl I know, and I was like, oh, maybe we'll have someone reach out. And then, like, I just got so much pressure. I promised that. And I was like, oh, I didn't know, right? So I think, and now that I see, like, some parents, you know, some teachers just go, oh, I'm just not going to reach out at all because I don't want to say the wrong thing, right? I mean, we've heard some of that discussion now. So But all, the risk right. also means that there can be incredible reward. If you think about a Rebbe who reaches out, wants right. a special relationship with a kid, that also that comes with tremendous risk, because it could be that, you know, they say, who's this right. Rebbe? And I, you know, the one parent wants nothing, so it's like, I can see why teachers step back and say, I don't want to do the wrong thing. I don't want my administrator to say the wrong thing. I don't want the school psychologist to think I'm trying to do the wrong. But actually, right, so there's like a big risk-reward calculus here. And thinking about teachers, I'm wondering, you know, sometimes we can say, oh, I apologize, I don't want to do the wrong thing, but sometimes you can really mess with stuff. Right, so.
I'll give you a little bit of fear about it.
So react to that. I want to hear
my reaction is, because I'm a trauma therapist, we have this all the time, right? We're going to re-traumatize them, right?
Can't hear
you. I'm going to be a little clear here. You're not going to re-traumatize them more than the trauma itself. Okay? They're already going through the divorce process. You're not going to make it worse than the divorce itself. Right? So just get on board with that. Okay? You're not going to make it worse than the divorce itself. Okay? Divorce is already tough. The problem. Right? Now, they may not want to think about it at school. Right.
This might be the safe haven. Has ended.
Right.
Please go to the cafeteria for the coffee.
I think it might be that you have to make it a place where they can or they don't have to do shit. Where it's just like, I know if you want to talk. And that's simply what it is. I know. If you want to do it. What? Right.
Thank you. I'm so sorry I was late, but it was excellent. And,
I have a question.
Sure.
What about boundaries? Because I do kindergarten.
You do what?
I teach kindergarten.
Yeah.
What about boundaries? Like, how far should I take a boundary? Because we have one where she's just everywhere. She kind of has been abusing her, the fact that we've been lenient with her.
Okay.
Because she's realized.
Okay.
She's realized it.
So there's boundaries in the physical sense, and there's boundaries in the emotional sense. Do you mean physical or emotional?
Like, physically, because, like, she doesn't like listening anymore. And, like, I get that, like, it's stressful.
Right.
But, like,
so physical, in my, there's no, physically, I don't think there's ever a reason why a kid should be hitting somebody. Because you're teaching them that it's okay to, like, harm somebody, and harm is not all right.
That she has, but it's, like, just, like, completely disregarding, like, teacher, completely disregarding classmates, just, like,
right.
just not listening.
So what we do is, what we have to do is just name the feeling. Right?
Yeah.
So to get them to name the feeling, usually often makes them drop down into feeling, so that way they don't act out as much. So you need to get her to feel the feeling, so that way she's not acting on the feeling. Right? You seem really mad. Are you mad? Are you angry? Yes, I'm angry. Hey, it's okay to be angry. What are you angry about? What are the name that she's angry about? Right? Because if we get to the anger, what is she angry about? What do you think she's angry about? The classroom, or do you think she's angry about something else?
Angry about other things. Like,
yeah, so get her to name what she's angry about.
Okay.
And then hopefully she'll stop acting out.
Alright, perfect. Thank you.
Hi. I teach second grade at Erie County.
Yeah.
So I have one student where, like, we knew in the beginning of the year, like set the divorce, and that now we're just told to take the father out of the email, like, he's out of
yes.
the picture, and I think it was probably the healthiest. I'm not supposed to judge, but
yes.
that's. But I have another student that we started the year where we knew there was separation, but it was just a week.